based on two things. First, it's based on the idea that we have not had a bilateral treaty with Haiti, and we have not had any reciprocation arrangements by way of an agreement. It is that agreement that was now sought to be had last week, which has still not been perfected. But it still leaves a lot of issues that are pending. The biggest issue is that under our constitution and our laws, our police force cannot be deployed abroad. Our police force is national. They can only operate within the Kenyan borders. On the contrary, it is the armed forces that can be deployed. For some strange reason, they have chosen to deploy the police, which still remains against the constitution. We have a constitution that clearly distinguishes between the police service and the defense forces. Only the forces can be deployed with the approval of the National Assembly. As we speak, and for reasons that I think Monique has already captured, we do not have any bilateral treaty arrangement between Kenya and Haiti. I think primarily also because there's no legitimate legislature or executive that can enter into that arrangement. And so the idea of the reciprocation agreement that was apparently entered last week or was being negotiated is still one that is not well-founded in the Constitution. But beyond that, we have questioned the process. The process is flawed from the one go. There was no request to this country to send any forces or any police officers. Instead, it is clear that our government offered, and immediately the offer was made. The President of the United States welcomed that move, and it is only thereafter that there was a move to bring the issue to the UN Security Council, by way of ratification. As I understand it, there was a general resolution which invited support. It was not specific to Kenya. It invited those who can, support to show support. It came at a time that there were active court orders which have still not been set aside. So the entire move is one that flies in the face of the rule of law. Thirdly, we keep saying that we have thousands of armed forces, personnel who are in the barracks, and we have police officers who are not even enough to man this country. As you may have seen in the papers, there are pockets of insurrections in this country and deaths. They're in a place called Baringo. People were killed 3 days ago in a place called Samburu, even as late as yesterday. And so our argument is you cannot deploy the police abroad when you need the police in Kenya. In terms of priority, and I think Monique said some things that are very profound in terms of history, we think that in terms of assistance, there are countries that carry the higher burden of intervention than Kenya. Countries that have had historical involvement with Haiti, countries that have much more superior defense forces that could intervene, countries that have been seen to intervene elsewhere. And why they would then backpass and ask Kenya to send 1,000 police officers is what we are questioning. It just amounts to backpassing. From what Monique described and what we've seen in the media, 1,000 police officers, even if there were 5,000, yeah, cannot bring any sanity to the situation. So we are very worried that the 1,000 police officers sent to Haiti, we are not sure where they are right now anyway, but we fear
Amoyo, if I can, I just wanted to get in Jake Johnston because we're almost running out of time. And Jake, I wanted to have your last comments. This whole issue of whether a peaceful change in Haiti can occur or whether the failure of the government, the threat of new international intervention and the desperate situation of the Haitian people really does call for some kind of a armed revolt by the people of Haiti, your sense of that?
Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, in regard to the Kenya mission, right, I mean, we have to understand that there was United Nations peacekeepers following the 2004 coup d'etat that were in the country for 13 years at a cost of over $7 billion. And so we're now talking about doing this, but the situation on the ground is a reminder of the failure of those efforts, right? We're talking about a situation now in Haiti where police can't even get paid, and we're shocked that they're not putting up more resistance. So I think, you know, the solutions are local. They can be local, right? International actors have a role to play in supporting action. Local solutions rather than undermining local institutions and local organizations, which has been a pattern repeated ad nauseum over Haiti's history, right? So I think there can be a peaceful resolution, but it's going to take change in policies both in Haiti and especially in the United States as well.
Jake Johnston, we want to thank you for being with us. Runs the Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch blog for Center for Economic and Policy Research. His new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti. We want to thank Monique Kleska, Haitian pro-democracy advocate, speaking to us from Port-au-Prince, and Otiende Omolo, Kenyan member of parliament, speaking to us from Nairobi. Next up, federal prosecutors rest their case against the former Honduran president accused of turning Honduras into a narco state. We'll get the latest in 20 seconds. Organization Mondial Yo Papun Yo Ye Salaboué de Volé Yo Pié de Volé Les peps qui l'ont dit Franchisi Yo Koné Yo Bouquet La médecine internationale, ça met col sous côté. Yo fait réunion, yo parle, yo rancé. Devant vers champagne, bon divin, qu'importe, c'est là s'arrêter.
World Organizations by Mano Charlemagne. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Here in New York, prosecutors have rested their case against the former Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who's on trial for cocaine trafficking and weapons charges as prosecutors accuse Hernandez of ruling the Central American country as a narco state. He's the first former head of state to stand trial in the U.S. since the Panamanian dictator and U.S. ally Manuel Noriega, who was ousted in 1989 when U.S. forces invaded Panama, and later he was convicted on drug charges. Hernandez is accused of accepting millions of dollars in bribes from cocaine traffickers in exchange for protection. During the trial, several convicted drug traffickers testified against him, including some affiliated with the Sinaloa cartel and the son of another former U.S.-backed Honduran president, Porfirio Pepe Lobo Sosa. Hernandez was arrested in February 2022, less than a month after his presidential term ended, and extradited to the U.S. in April of 2022. He was a longtime U.S. ally who received backing during his entire eight-year term, despite mounting reports of human rights violations and accusations of corruption involvement with drug smuggling. His brother, Tony Hernandez, Juan Antonio Hernandez, is now serving a prison sentence in the U.S., a life sentence after being convicted in 2019 of smuggling cocaine. Juan Orlando Hernandez faces life in prison if convicted as well. For more, we're joined by two guests who've been attending the trial in New York. Dana Frank is professor of history emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror in the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. And Oscar Estrada, a Honduran writer and screenwriter. His latest book, Land of Narcos, How the Mafias Took Over Honduras. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Frank, why don't you start by giving us the overall context before we get into what's testified at this trial?
The main thing here is that the U.S. is apparently deciding to decided to try one of its most important allies. And the overall context of this is, of course, the U.S. support for the 2009 military coup, which the U.S. backed and allowed to stabilize. And that, in turn, destroyed the rule of law in Honduras. So it's not just that Juan Orlando is randomly a corrupt drug trafficker and repressive figure, but the U.S. supported him. They supported the previous president, Porfirio Pepe Lobo, and allowed the destruction of the rule of law, which then opened the door for the kind of criminal behavior and drug trafficking, not only by the narcos, but by figures at the top of the military, the government, and the police.
Uh, I'd like to ask Oscar Estrada, you've also been at the trial. What struck you most about it so far? Especially, could you talk about the testimony of Fabio Lobo, son of the former president, Porfirio Lobo?
Yeah, I think at this point it's been shown very clear the involvement of narco money, narcotraffic money into Honduran elections. And it's very interesting that United States prosecutors now is trying to back up for the original indictment about election fraud in the 2013 election, which is the one that been shown the most. And I think that all the different witnesses are saying that they pay bribe for the different candidates in the United States. And I think the Honduran people have been expecting more about this trial in the sense that we're trying to see what happened in the elections, what happened with all these different narco-traffic involvement on political campaign. And with Fabio Lobo, I think that it's very clear his delivery in the witness day that he has a lot more to say that it wasn't really show there. And at the end, it shows like a man full of resentment of his father and a different political figure that left him alone when he was arrested in Haiti in 2015.
And Dana Frank, why did the United States turn so dramatically against a leader that it supported for two terms in office, one of which was ostensibly an illegal term?
Well, I think the first term, I mean, you see the amount of money that flowed in from narcos for his first term has come out in the trial. So I think that underscores how corrupt both elections were, which I've been saying all along, as have many Hondurans. I think the question is to answer how the U.S. turned on Juan Orlando is like you have to disaggregate who the United States is in here, because it's been the Southern District of New York that's been independently following these cases, building the case that have led to Juan Orlando Hernandez, and before that, his brother Tony. And the evidence that I know is that the U.S., the White House and the State Department have not been happy about this. I mean, I've interviewed officials at the State Department and three different ambassadors, and it was clear they were very hostile to the Southern District and all these cases that they've been gaining. And it's also clear that although Obama and Trump and Biden all supported Juan Orlando Hernandez, Biden did not want the Southern District of New York to charge and extradite Juan Orlando Hernandez until after Hernandez was out of office. And so it's like very important, because otherwise it looks like the U.S., you know, there's a narrative here that you could see in the New York Times, for example, that suddenly the Honduran people can't govern themselves. And then suddenly the U.S. is coming in and heroically imposing the rule of law. And it's the opposite. It's the United States that helped destroy the criminal justice system in Honduras, and Obama and Trump did not want Juan Orlando to be charged and extradited.
So, Oscar Estrada, if you can talk about the human rights situation on the ground when Joe, J-O-H, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was president, for example, turning the Honduran military essentially into private security guards for drug traffickers, and what that meant for human rights activists and people on the ground who are critical of the president.
Well, it's clear that we have seen since the coup d'etat in 2009 a deterioration of the human rights situation in Honduras. And from then on, you know, like pretty much all the last decades, it's been a lot of accusation of violation of human rights. And the military role is very important. And we see it now with his defense. What we see in generals of the army actually came here and taking the stand supporting his defense. It's very clear that he was backed up by the military from the beginning, and the military is now defending him. So it's clear that the army in Honduras, even though they're trying to back it up from this military officers, generals, most of them, they are like in the stand for the defense witness. They're trying to back it up, but it's clear that it still have a lot of influence inside the army.
And Dana, Frank, I wanted to ask you, it's been 2 years since Xiomara Castro was elected president at the head of a popular movement in Honduras. Has U.S. policy toward Honduras changed at all, or is it still backing the corrupt elite of the former presidents?
Well, there's a very clear pattern since very early on when Xiomara first took office of the U.S. supporting the very same actors it has for many years, working with the National Party, that's Juan Orlando Hernandez's party, working with corrupt figures at the top of the National Party. The actual head of the party is a fugitive from justice as we speak, and trying to pressure Libre, the ruling party, to accept National Party as an equal actor. And the U.S. Ambassador Lara Dogo has very aggressively been trying to undermine human Honduran sovereignty, opposing tax reform law, opposing the reform electrical system, very aggressively supporting the ZEDES, which are these so-called model cities that are total violation of the Honduran Constitution. It's very clear that the U.S. agenda is to support transnational corporate investments in Honduras, which it always has. And, of course, it cares about Honduras as part of its larger geopolitical effort to militarily dominate the hemisphere.
And finally, Oscar, the former head of Honduras' national police pleaded guilty Tuesday to cocaine trafficking. Juan Carlos Bonilla, known as El Tigre, appeared in a New York City court just days before he was scheduled to go on trial with the president, with Juan Orlando Hernandez. Can you talk about the significance of his guilty plea as we wrap up?
Well, I think that we in Honduras, we would want it. Tigre Bonilla to be persecuted for all his human rights violation record, which is very well known and recorded in Honduras. Instead of that, he's playing guilty for one charge of narcotraffic. What we don't want is for that to be a cover-up of this record of human rights violation from the coup d'etat, and way before he was one of the leaders of the one death squads in the early 2000s, and very famous. And he built a career as a repressor, and now that he's been sentenced, I mean, he's going to be sentenced in the South District Court in the United States. We want to know more about what else have he done during this time in the being chief of police.
And Professor Frank, we just have 30 seconds, but as the U.S. increasingly criminalizes immigrants coming into this country, the huge flow of, for example, Honduran immigrants, the connection between migration and what the U.S. has supported on Honduras.
Well, people are fleeing because they're fleeing the gangs, they're fleeing poverty, and they're fleeing the post-coup regime, three different presidents that have destroyed the country and have been backed by the United States in doing that. The United States is the single biggest factor creating the crisis in Honduras, the single biggest factor why people are fleeing. And then it turns around and says somehow they're a disaster down there independently, when actually it's the U.S. that's responsible for why people are fleeing Honduras.
Dana Frank, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of History Emerita at University of California, Santa Cruz, and Oscar Estrada, Honduran writer and screenwriter. His latest book, Land of Narcos, How the Mafias Took Over Honduras. Coming up, we speak with the producer of the Oscar-nominated Holocaust film, Zone of Interest, who raised Israel's assault on Gaza in his BAFTA Acceptance Award. Stay with us. Johann Strauss's Tales from the Vienna Woods, performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with the producer of the Oscar-nominated Holocaust film, Zone of Interest, about the family of Nazi Commandant Rudolf Haas living in a tranquil life on the opposite side of the wall of the Auschwitz concentration camp. First, this is the film's trailer.
These flowers are so beautiful.
The azaleas there. There are also vegetables. A few herbs, rosemary, beetroot. This is fennel, sunflowers. And here's kohlrabi. The children love to eat it.
The heartfelt time we spent in the Haas house will always be among our most beautiful holiday memories. In the east lies our tomorrow. Thanks for your National Socialist hospitality.
The Zone of Interest just won three BAFTA awards last month for Best Sound, Best British Film, and Best Film Not in the English Language. During his acceptance speech, producer James Wilson raised Israel's assault on Gaza.
A friend wrote me after seeing the film the other day that he couldn't stop thinking about the walls we construct in our lives, which we choose not to look behind. Those walls aren't new from before or during or since the Holocaust, and it seems stark right now that we should care about innocent people being killed in Gaza or Yemen in the same way we think about innocent people being killed in Mariupol or in Israel.
For more, we're joined by James Wilson, producer of the Oscar-nominated film The Zone of Interest. Nominated for Best Picture, among others, the Oscar ceremony is Sunday, Best International Picture. Congratulations, James Wilson, on all the nominations and what you won at the BAFTAs. Talk about that experience and why you related what's happening now with Israel's assault on Gaza to this Holocaust film, and talk specifically about that wall that separated the commandant's home from the Auschwitz concentration camp.
Well, thank you, Amy. Good morning. Thank you for inviting me on the show. Why I said that? I mean, as you heard in the clip, I related the film both to the In the present moment, to the Israeli assault on Gaza, but also the innocent victims in Israel on October the 7th, and I mentioned Yemen, and I mentioned Ukraine too, Mariupol too. So the context of that, which felt organic to the idea of the film, the questions of the film. You know, I know politics in film award speeches can grate sometimes, but this, as I said, this felt very pertinent to what the film's about, which is as you say, the walls that separate us from things that we choose not to look at, just as the friend who'd messaged me about the film saying he couldn't stop thinking about that. In his own daily life, and all of that just came together. I was obviously thinking about it beforehand. It was a nervous moment just to speak in front of a lot of people. I've never won an award for a film I've worked on, but it felt organic to the idea of the film. And you mentioned the wall in the film, and of course, it's. The film stages an absolutely real situation, which is the family of the commandant of Auschwitz and his wife and the family and the life they led in a nice house and garden that exactly abutted Auschwitz in full operation in the early 1940s and that wall, which is in the film and in that situation is absolutely real, is of course also a metaphor for, as my friend's message said, the way we can sort of occlude and tune out systematic violence, injustice, oppression, all sorts of things from our lives in order that we go on with them. I suppose the film asks that question. What are the walls in our lives? Like, do we have walls like that in our life? Are there groups of people whom we care about more than others as groups of people socially, not as friends and family? And it seems quite clear that that is the case. And I suppose the other thing about the film is we always wanted it to be feel modern and feel about the present, everything about how we made it, how John Glazer, the writer director of the film, wanted to make it, was to make it feel like it was happening in the present and it reflected the present. And that was through the tools of filmmaking, cinematography, acting, music, sound design, to create this immersive feeling of present tenseness, which was a means to an hopeful end, which was to reflect us in the present. And John's also spoken about how it's a political film. And one of the things that's happening in the present is this extraordinary, staggering loss of innocent life in killing of innocent people in Gaza and in the occupied territories that is a response to the heinous mass killing of October the 7th. But it just seems very stark in the world that we have politically, our governments at least, have a different level of care and attitude to those innocent people being killed in Gaza and in Yemen, and of course in other, this selective empathy, I think, marks hundreds of years of human history, and I mentioned that I spoke to that in the brief speech I was able to make. And isn't just something that was happening, from 1940 to 45 in Germany. So all of those things sort of came together in that moment, in that speech.
And James Wilson, you mentioned the commandant of Auschwitz and his family. What was the challenge in getting the audience to identify with these main characters, with this idyllic family, up against this incomprehensible terror and destruction that was happening that was occurring and that he was presiding over?
Well, I mean, in a way, the challenge that you identify sort of is the core of the film, I think. The questions of the film, I mean, it's not a polemical film. There's not like a message we're trying to pin it, tie it up with a neat bow. But I think the whole question of the film and the idea, the thinking space of the film, it's a film, I think, that asks you to, it tries to make a space in which you can think, was to lean into some kind of identification with those people, the commandant of Auschwitz and his partner, his wife, to look for the similarities, not the differences. The typical way the Holocaust is narrated is of it's the discourse of what's called Holocaust exceptionalism, right? That the Holocaust stands apart from history, outside of history, as the sort of mythic, almost evil, mystical event. And there's something apolitical and ahistorical in that idea. So the idea of this film was to look for the similarities rather than the differences between us and the perpetrator.
And I wanted to go to a clip from your film when Nazi Commandant Rudolf Haas's wife, Hedwig Hensel, speaks to her mother.
Is that the camp wall?
Yes, that's the camp wall. We planted more vines at the back to grow and cover it.
Maybe Esther Silverman is over there.
Which one was she?
The one I used to clean for.
James Wilson, 10 seconds to wrap.
Well, I mean, just to pick up that last point, it was to look for all those all those details and aspects of our lives in terms of our aspirations, our desire for household comfort, the things that motivated and drove them that
James Wilson, we're going to leave it there. Congratulations on your Oscar nominations for international film at the Oscars. The Zone of Interest. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, we are Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.